I really want to be willing clay in my master's hands. And if that happens, I am so very happy. But when to feel those things that you said probably would not make me a very nice person. But that sounded so good, and I'm so glad you said that.
And it's recorded.
And it's been delightful to be here. And I'm looking forward to another week of this beautiful, beautiful time I've had. And you do talk pretty.
Oh.
Now, no great occasion becomes great without the response and the participation of all those who are involved in it. Jim has made his contribution, and with him we would not want to make that, pretend that we would make that greater than it is, because it's been the response of the people as he's met with them. He has performed his enabling function, and the same will be true of this consultation. The more we put into it as participants, the greater occasion it will be. The more our ministry to him will be extended, for it is a two-way street. And I ask that, though I don't need to remind you, of course, that you will have in mind a number of things as the consultation progresses, that you are here not in your own right, but that your ministry qualification to others is what brings you here. And that with a sense of responsibility to that, as perhaps for the only time that we will be exposed to some insights of the gospel and the ministry, this special ministry within the life of the church and our community, that Jim Pearson can bring a sense of the urgency not to miss anything. I try to become a father figure too often. I think I'm talking to campers. But little things like spending time on less important things and not getting enough sleep so that our degree of concentration is really a betrayal of what things we could miss by that here that we will never have the opportunity again, which will be needed in skills and understandings and insights and perceptions in a special crisis occasion even perhaps. Or in the ordinary ongoing quality of our own ministry to other people, we will miss if we give things to less important than the agenda and the extracurricular things in deep conversations in meal times and at other times as we share together. We also have a ministry to each other because there are people perhaps we will never meet again across our state, denominational and other interest boundaries. And that is always the case in a camp residential situation. That's its high value. The extracurricular things become sometimes of the essence of the task. And as we talk together and share together, not in the groups that we have come together here to this conference, but to those that we have not known before, and give them the insights and the wealth of our experience. And I'm sure that any Jim Pearson, and this one in particular, would say to us, I need your ministry. And if you have an experience, I want to add that experience to me. In fact, he will be betrayed to the extent that we don't do that and feel equally responsible to him or to our other leaders in the consultation. So the consultation is made up of the ones who will be giving the input, and in this case, Jim Pearson in particular, but no less. When our turn comes, the quality and the necessity of adding our experience to others who are dependent upon it and expecting it, and will be betrayed to the extent that we are not prepared to, too shy to perhaps, initially, when we overcome that weakness, to share it. So we have an obligation to each other to make this first national consultation all that it can be. I want to express my regret that I will not be here to participate past this morning, but I have to go to Bundaberg and Gingin. That's a great place to be there in worship service with them tonight. But I will be thinking of you occasionally, and ask that in tomorrow's responsibilities, my responsibilities tomorrow, as part of my message will be about crossroads in that area too, that your thoughts and prayers will be with me. I will often think of you, as we do in Queensland, those of you who are engaged in giving so much of the wealth of your experience and the value of your time and energy in a voluntary capacity right around Queensland now, the privilege of being here at this national consultation will widen those parameters, and I will feel that we belong in Crossroads to a national family. And I will often, as driving and flying and relaxing and talking, feel that I am part of you and that you are part of us, that we belong together in this common ministry. The last thing I want to say is my favourite theme that Jim and Ed and others who've been where I've been and said this before have heard, and that is that I really believe that the solution to a lot of budgetary financial limitations upon our ministry can be overcome not only in an area like Crossroads with the skills and the time and the energy of the voluntary sector in our community joining with government and community and civic and church resources. The voluntary sector, when tens of thousands of person hours, we got to say, haven't we? Not man hours, can be given that nobody could afford to pay. Millions of dollars, that's what you are worth. And all that we seem to lack at points is a highly developed professional skill of quality controlling, of enthusing, of supporting voluntary labour that's there for the asking, that will be worth billions of dollars that nobody could ever generate or afford. And I believe that we've been heard because of Jim Pearson's visit in making that sort of offer. And already one university has made an approach to me that we may extend the discipline of that skill of voluntarism, joined with the professionalism that is available in increasing numbers and amount of persons and time and finance that government and other agencies are prepared to give. And this last thing in that respect, within our own Department of Welfare Services in this state, there is going on currently a big reshuffling. And the philosophy that's underlying that is we must not, as a government or government agencies, attempt to do any longer the costly business of a work ourselves that can be done by trusted, accountable, voluntary agencies. And so a whole new area of government policy is being developed, and I believe we are making our contribution to that in this particular state that will generate a lot of energy and ministry and educative processes that will be of great benefit in future to the whole of mankind. And you here in this first national conference, I really believe with confidence, are making some history that will be written and read, enthused about, reflected upon for many, many years to come. Aren't we great? I have much pleasure being very formal now and officially declaring the first national consultation on ministry to the disabled in Australia open.
Thank you, Lewis. Now, we want to make as much use of the time available from Jim, and so we ask that he comes and gives us our first lecture on the challenge to the church. If there are any who have come just in the last few minutes, would you make sure that you have your kit? And that will be good. Thank you, Cheryl. Thank you, Jim.
I really do appreciate your kind remarks. I've had the greatest sense about this entire trip from the very beginning, and the sense was that it was something that the Lord wanted done, and all the details were going to be worked out. And that has happened. And so it's that kind of a, in trying to think how I feel about what you said, while I feel very good, I appreciate the feeling of knowing that if God is in charge of things and His will and His ends are being accomplished, then it's very difficult for things to go wrong. And even when we do feel that things have gone wrong, sometimes that's just our misinterpretation of what happened in the first place. So it's been a pleasure to be here, and I want you to know how good I feel about that, and your wonderful wife. I will never, never forget you. Now, in the time that I have to talk today, I hope I get at least a summary of all the concepts that we have talked about in my trip around through and in the middle of your beautiful country. But in order to talk about the challenge of the church in ministry to variously handicapped persons, I think there is a place that we have got to start that probably you didn't think I was going to start there. I am convinced that one of the reasons that we do not quickly get into the service areas that we need to get into in the church is that we have sort of forgotten what it is that the church is all about in the first place. We have looked on the church, and our verbiage in talking about the church is that we are going to put up a beautiful building and we're going to fill it full of people, and then the people are going to come in to serve the church. They're going to be there to be counted. They're going to be there to give money. And that service to the church is sort of the attitude that we express. Now, if we keep that kind of a concept, all of the human need going on about us is never really going to be met in the name of Jesus Christ. The church is made up, fortunately or unfortunately, of us. We're it. And we are those people who are going to represent the church. Now, if you'll let me be biblical for a minute, we are living epistles, letters, if you will, to be seen and read of all people. So that says more than I've got to come to church and give my dollar and I've got to come to church to get myself counted. That says that the church is put here to serve. I'm not supposed to look around for people to wait upon me, to provide all my needs, to fuss when I don't feel I have been adequately treated by the church, or the church has not provided me with what I wanted the church to provide me with in the first place. That's my job. And you know the most interesting thing about that concept of giving, that concept of service, is that when I give, I am served by that process. Now did that go? You see, and when I am in that kind of a giving posture, then all of that service comes back to me, because in doing the service, I have done it for Jesus Christ. Now, are you still holding on to me? Yes. You see, and when we operate in that kind of a service delivery system, if you will, it can't go wrong. And we're not going to sit around and talk about, Christians, where the needs really are. Because we're going to know those things. And we're going to be in the process of meeting those needs every day. I pray for Crossroads that eventually it will lose the name Crossroads and the service that's rendered will just be rendered without any kind of fancy title. That we won't even have to refer to it as a special kind of a ministry. Because you see, all of that is just going to happen naturally as I give. Now, I've already put myself in a position to have to talk about something. In order for us to be the kind of people in the church that we ought to be, we have got to look at who we are. We've got to look at ourselves and really know what it is that we have to offer. What is our gift? What is it that you as a person have to give that is uniquely you? When you walked into this room, what did you give us? That is something that has got to be talked about more in the church. And the leadership of the church has as a responsibility to seek out in people who come to church, what is your gift? What is it that you have to offer? Now, I fear sometimes if we do not have the gift of gab and the ability to sing on key, play some instruments from time to time, and, you know, do a little work in the office and those kinds of things that usually make up church activities, sometimes people just get sort of left out. And we sort of look at those as gifts. But that's not the gift of the church. There are so many things that all of us have every day that we offer. Now, I don't want to be exhaustive because I am not an exhaustive person. I just, you know, when I get my thimble out, I don't fill very many buckets. But I want to suggest some gifts. Gifts that we don't usually think about. The gift of thinking that the person who is sitting next to you is more important than you are. Would that make the world a better place to live in if we really felt that way? That's a gift. That person as an individual is more important than I am. And I don't feel that I have to have any special considerations at the expense of the person who's sitting next to me. That's a gift. And that marvelous gift of making people feel that we know that they're more important than we are. That gift of making people feel special. I have a friend that I like to go sometimes just to be with, and he said to me one day, he said, Jim, you know, we're together a lot, and I always feel that it's sort of a one-way thing, that I gain from you and you don't gain anything from me. And I said, oh, if I have let you go this long without saying this to you, when I leave you, I feel 10 feet tall, you know. And I just need that once in a while for somebody to make me feel special. And all of us, regardless of the fact that we, in our more religious moments, would not want to confess that at all, like to feel that way. We like to feel that there's nobody in the world but us, and there's somebody in the world who cares for us exclusively, and that's a marvelous human feeling that we can give to people around us. Now, I want to tell you something else, another little gift, is the gift of touch. Now, I feel very confined, and I'm going to have to do what my friend said, and I'm going to stop talking a minute. I'm going to go over here and get my... All right.
Just put it in display.
I can't tell you how... Okay, just a minute. Am I all right? All right. One of the things that we feel so obligated to do is to talk. Now, don't anybody tell me not to keep talking. You know, I don't, that would bother me. But we just feel that compulsion to talk and get words out and keep words going and keep moving, you see. But to be so involved with a person's situation that we know exactly when to apply the touch of who we are, that's important. I have or had a very good friend who was going through an awful divorce. It was just one of those things that would never end. And I knew on this particular day that she had to go to the attorney and that it was going to be one of those grueling kinds of mornings. Now, I knew all that information in my head. In the middle of the day, I ran into a department store to pick up something for my wife. And as I ran through the door, I saw this lady standing over by this table of purses, pocketbooks, whatever you call those things that you ladies carry here with you. And she was very, very sort of not into looking for one to select. And as I walked by her, I just nodded and caught her eye, and then I just took her hand like that and gave it a squeeze and got on the lift and went on up to where I was supposed to be to buy what I wanted. And 2 or 3 days from that, I got a lengthy letter from her expressing to me her deepest appreciation for all the wonderful things that I had said to her that had helped her. Well, thinking that she might have had somebody to say a lot of things to her and she was expressing the wrong appreciation to the wrong person, I went to see her and I said, now, you have me wrong. I said, I haven't even talked to you about this.
Oh, she says, you remember all those things that you said to me when you saw me in the store when I was selecting a purse? And I said, I did not say a word to you. The only thing I did was to squeeze your hand. Now, Christians, we forget that. that common touch involves us with people. And that's a gift. It's important that we learn that the gifts that we have to offer are us. Not a lot of fancy ability and not a lot of fancy talent. But I want to tell you what happens. Our wonderful Lord put things together in ways that we'll never know how to do. Do you know He says to us, if we take care of the tiny little talents that we have, He'll add them to us. And it won't be so long until we'll be multi-talented people. And as we give those gifts, we will have more gifts to give. Now, if anybody hasn't caught on to what I'm saying, we cannot minister to anybody unless we are first and foremost at peace with ourselves and who we are and what we're about and know what it is that we have to offer to people around us. And I don't want anybody to think that I am suggesting in saying that there are some people who do not have anything to offer. Everybody has something to offer, regardless of how they feel. And whether we realize it or not, we are making that contribution at this very minute to the people sitting next to us, the people in the room with us. Now, do you see why I strongly feel that we can't talk about ministry unless we talk about who we are? How do we keep ourselves in shape? How do we keep ourselves in that kind of a posture that giving process is always there? I think our wonderful Lord told us how. I always like those times in His ministry that He felt the compulsion to be away from it all. Wanted to get off by Himself in a private place. Now, I didn't come to fuss at anybody, but we don't do that enough. And let the wonderful Spirit of God minister to us and sort of fill us up and clean us out and vibrate us and do all those kinds of things. Just a few minutes by ourselves sort of puts that life back into us. And those times that we sit down with God's Word and just let those beautiful truths hit our heads again. You know, that's another strange sort of a book. Most of us have read it through several times. And every time we read it, it gets different. Now there's just something about that says that if we neglect that kind of strengthening, and then when we come up from out of those kinds of periods of being with God, relaxing with God, I like to say, well, our service to people around us will just change overnight, and we feel that mutual flowing and giving to each other, and then we don't pay a whole lot of attention to what color the skin is, whether it's male or female, bond or free, able or disabled. Those little distinctions just sort of start not making one iota of difference. And then our service delivery system as a Christian sort of becomes automatic. Now, I have worked for 20 years. Started working when I was 2. gave me a little box so I could stand up on it so everybody could see me when I talk. No, I have worked for 20 years helping train ministerial students. And I just teach one little course. Used to teach a little more than that. But one of the things that I'd always say to my classes is that I want you to forget this business about preparing for the ministry. You're doing it right now. I said, what's going to happen if at the end of this day you die. And you are preparing for the ministry. You've not ministered. Now, everybody understands what I'm talking about. But what I want to convey to us, if we've got who we are together, we're going to minister. You know why that's so easy to do? I really appreciate what you said, Lou. There's no way that I can tell you what strength I get from my wife and daughters. Even in the hassling times. Now, you know, home sweet home, sometimes we turn the sign, you know. But all of that that comes in, that's important. That stabilizing factor, that on that personal human kind of thing, that's all right. But you know my wonderful Christian friends from Australia, I have a far more marvelous relationship than that. The grace of God makes us who and what we are. And that gives us no opportunity and leaves no room for me to maintain a posture that up here I am and down there you are. It says to me, living and working in the grace of God, here we are together, one-on-one, eyeball-to-eyeball, creature-to-creature. And if you really feel that way, you can't help but minister. Right, Julie? Now, I just had to say that. That's what I wanted to say before I wanted to say something before I started talking. When you said that a minute ago, Lou, I just had to say that. I had something I wanted to say before I started talking. Now, with that little bit out of the way, I want to say, and then talk the rest of the time that I've got to talk to you today, that the church is obligated to take the gospel to persons who are intellectually handicapped. Period. No modifiers, little discussion, but no modifiers. Now, I'll tell you the reason I feel that way. Everybody in this room today is not on the same physical ability level. But you're all here. Nobody's having any trouble understanding what I'm saying. As long as I don't call a cookie a biscuit. Or a biscuit a scone. Do you understand what I'm saying? Everybody in this room, those of you who have to have special devices to sit, to be here, you are understanding cognitively what everybody else is understanding. Now, I just sort of think that we need to stop using words that describe that. We can see that. And without any kind of question, and without any kind of committee meetings, we need to arrange to make it convenient for those people who happen to have those various disabilities, to conveniently get into the building. But there's another side to that that I want to say. I think it's high time that in our process of providing those services, that we make everybody feel comfortable in the church house. And that kind of comfortableness comes about in a real atmosphere of love and concern. Now, I want to illustrate with my own personal feelings. I feel comfortable with you. For most of our lives, we have been 18,000 miles from each other. We speak English with a different accent. But I don't feel out of place here. If anything, I feel very much in place and have that tinge of sadness in my heart that next Saturday when they call Qantas Flight 9 at the Brisbane International Airport, that many of the wonderful people here that I will never see again, you know, that sort of bothers me. I wish we were closer. I wish I could hop in my car driving on the right side of the road and run over to see you. But you see, do you know why we feel comfortable with each other? When I walked in here last night and met many of you, I got hugs and I gave hugs. It's the most beautiful four-letter word in the world. L-O-V-E. Now, what we have done sometimes with persons in the church who are not just like us is to substitute that beautiful word with a dirty four-letter word, P-I-T-Y. Nothing is as bad as pity. And when I get that pity level started, I don't have that love going. And when I have pity going, I'm making everybody around me feel uncomfortable. Now, go back to my first point. When I am in a situation to pity you, up here I am, and down there you are. You see? And it just doesn't happen. So if that's my first concept to convey about ministry in the church to persons who happen to have problems, then that kind of a feeling, comfortable feeling of being loved in spite of the fact that we're not just alike, then goes a long way to being the heart of what ministry is all about. Reaching out, loving, supporting, being a part of, feeling comfortable. Do you know, now I have seen a couple of advertisements in books that I have flipped through here. Bill and Gloria Gaither, marvelous Christian singers in America. Did they ever get over to Australia to sing? I've heard their music, but they have written a song that addresses this very issue, and it's something like, I am loved, so I can risk loving you. You see that? Because I have all of that love going on, I can take the risk of loving and caring about everybody. Because you see, more than in the sense that we do it when we get international, we are brothers and sisters. But let me tell you something. We are brothers and sisters. And we need to express that love to everybody. Now, so you see, we're talking in the main today about ministering to persons who are intellectually handicapped, because that's really going to be the problem. I'm convinced that it's the most difficult ministry to mount in the whole of the church. Because you see, what we are faced with, now, am I still doing all right? Can he still hear me out there? I don't want to upset him. Do I get one of these? No. Do I get one of these? You have about a week. Oh, he's got a week. He's got plenty of time. Now you see, we come now to the Great Commission. And I want to take out of that Great Commission two words. Teach and creature. Because involved therein is the essence of what we're here about. You see, when we teach, we take an idea from one head and transfer it to the head of the other person. So when we have that kind of a setup going, we know that our Heavenly Father wants us to teach His Word. All right, the Word was given with all apologies to all the theologians in this room, this is my little rough way of getting at this. The gospel, Jesus came down here to show us how to do. He gave that to 12 men. They gave it. And they gave it. Now, Christians, listen to this. We are a part of that line of giving the gospel. Does that excite you? Oh, that just thrills me. And see, that gives me that feeling of importance. That if God had so elected, He could have chosen to do that teaching process by just having it written on every blade of grass. You see, He could have put that message on every blade of grass. God just has so much creativity that He could have done anything that He wanted to get that message over. Or it could have been that every time certain kinds of clouds would go up in the sky, that it could be seen by the eyes of all mankind, that the message could have been written on a cloud and just changed into whatever language it was. But He elected. Now get the excitement of this. He chose to let that teaching be done by people who had been taught. And we pass that word along. And the only way that we can do that is from one person taking it to another person. Now, I do not care how much money we spend on multimedia systems, television, radio, all those things. Nothing takes the place of that one-on-one contact. It's God's basic way to communicate the marvelous messages that He wants communicated. So when we teach, that gospel, it's conveying that from one mind to the other. Now, sometimes this mind gets the brain that makes this mind, through no fault of its own, suffers damage. And that damage results in all that information not being able to be fed in there just right. Now, when that happens, that does not say, well, because the information cannot be fed in the normal ways, we don't have to do anything about it. It's not so at all. Because I want to give you some information. Now I'm going to sound like a lecturer. I never feel like I lecture. Is that wrong for me never to feel like I lecture? Sometimes I feel embarrassed. I just get up and talk, and that's a little bit embarrassing sometimes. Intellectually handicapped persons easily fall into three categories. Just snap, 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 like that. Up here on the top are those who can be educated. Now wait just a minute. They can be educated. They can get up to be 13 or 16 years of age. That's where they would peak socially. Mentally. Now, is that a mission lesson in itself, sort of? You know? What does that say, 13 to 16 years of age? Well, yeah, they are accountable for their sins. You know, I think we need to talk church talking church. That they are accountable for what they... Now, many of these persons will be able to manage their own affairs and all those. Now, here we have those who can be trained. Now, they get just to about 7 to 8 years of age. Little second graders in school. Year two in school. They don't get very far. Now, sometimes the complicated things of life, like marriage and keeping a job, a regular job, that would bring in enough money for them, and all those kinds of things, they just can't handle. And they're going to have somebody to supervise them. Now, bottom on the list would be those who need constant care. Now, I want you to notice that I'm doing my best to stay away from labels. Are you catching on to what I'm doing? I want us to describe situations and not put names on things. These persons need constant care. They probably would be between the 4 and 5 year old level mentally and would not be able to do anything on their own. They'd always have to have somebody in the business of taking care of them. 24-hour-a-day care. Now, when I look at that, that says a lot to me, because do you know that in Australia, America, and in most countries of the world, 85% of the total intellectually handicapped population can be educated. They can be taught to read and write. and they can be taught. They can be taught the marvelous truths about Jesus Christ to the point that they can accept Him. So that just leaves 15% that really need special consideration. Did you hear what I said? So you see, what I am doing very quickly is making this ministry not a very special ministry at all. It's just a teaching kind of a concept that we have got to get into our minds, and then we convey those wonderful truths and those wonderful messages. Now, I want to go down through there, though, because I did something down in Sydney that I didn't mean to do. I think I was talking too fast, and I left out a little point that somebody fortunately asked me about, and I got to talk about a little more. If you could have seen this young man, I doubt seriously that you would quickly have invited him to your church. But I went to do a meeting in a church, and the minister said to me, "Oh, Jim, I'm glad you're here." Now, when they say that, I know they've got a problem. And I said, "All right, who is it that you want me to talk to especially?" And he said, "How did you know?" And I said, "Well, everybody does that." And it was about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and he said, "There's a young man that I want you to go see." So I went into a mobile home. Is that what you call those? Mobile home? What is it?
Caravan.
All right. Fine. But no, it's all right. Sometimes if it's in the range, but sometimes I have to say point to it, and then I've got it. Oh, a bonnet of a car. I looked for it. You throw a little bonnet up on top of a little. So we went into this trailer home, very, very modest surroundings, and there sat a 21-year-old man who was intellectually handicapped. Now, on the way over to his dwelling, the minister had explained to me that he wanted to become a Christian. And I had just said to the minister, "Well, what's wrong?" Well, he said, "I am so afraid that he doesn't understand." So I said to him, "Let's don't stay here. Let's run down to the drugstore and pick up something to drink." Now, I notice that you don't have things to drink in your drugstores, but we do that. And so we went down and we had a Coke together. And I said, "Harry, the minister tells me that you want to become a Christian." And he said, "Oh, yes, yes." He said, "I'll tell you, I love the Lord." And he said, I want to become a Christian." And I said, "Well, you know, what does that mean, becoming a Christian?" "Well," he said, "I'm surprised a man like you would ask me that." And I said, no, I'd really like to know." Well, he said, "Let me tell you what happened." He said, "God said, Jesus, get down there, and they're being sinful. They're being bad. You take care of that. That's what God said to Jesus." And he said, "Those people put him up on a cross, and his blood came out of him. And it's that blood that's got to make the difference in all of us." And we finished our discussion, and I went back to my minister friend, and I said, "If the leadership of your congregation understood on the level that he understands, you would build churches one every year to accommodate the crowd." And I went to his church for his baptism. And when it was all accomplished, he walked up in the front and he said, "Maybe I shouldn't ask this, but," he said, "I've waited all my life to take the Lord's Supper. And I have never seen so much activity. Not only did he take the Lord's Supper, but we all rejoiced with him and did it again. He is as faithful to his church as he can be." But it took a mother and a Sunday school teacher who were willing to see to it that all of that information that culminated in "I want to be a Christian" was taught just right. it can happen. But what about these persons? Should we be concerned about teaching them? 1,000 times yes. With 2 or 3 exceptions, everyone. Fits into that category. And they are being taught. And their lives are being changed. Now, granted, to this point, we have not had any of them who got close to where Harry was or others. But the truths of Jesus Christ, his life and his ways, make a lot of difference in us. We have a man who comes to our church and works in the sheltered workshop. And the sheltered workshop superintendent said to me one day, I understand Randy comes to your church. And I said, that's correct. And he said, well, we're having a little problem with him. And I said, well, what's the problem? And he said, well, he's learned how to be late for work, but make it not show on the time card. And we don't quite know how to handle it. And I said, well, I think that's a rather sophisticated thing for somebody to be able to do. And he said, so I removed myself from that situation, and I went to his Sunday school teacher, and I said that we're having a little problem with honesty. I said, could you arrange in a Sunday or two to start some lessons on honesty? And it's one of those creative teachers. As a matter of fact, he's a dentist and who just wanted to be of some help in the Lord's work. And he said, I'll take care of that. And he got some lessons ready on honesty. What, you know? And I went in that morning, and he said, now, we need to find out what the Bible says about being honest. Well, you know, he had all these verses written and pictures drawn to illustrate all the principles. And it was a beautiful, marvelous lesson. And everybody was talking about it. Then the teacher said, now, let's talk about some ways that we can be dishonest without meaning to. So they suggested some. And then the teacher said, well, I've got one I'd like to suggest. He said, now, what about when you go to work and you punch your time card and you fix it so it looks like you got there on time when you were 15 minutes late? Well, I maintained my stately look, but I looked around and Randy had gone. But you know something? I gave it about a month, and I called workshop supervisor, and I said, how are things? He said, do you know, now I want you to get this, he said, do you know that Randy has not stopped giving the biblical principles of honesty for the last month? Now, is that helpful? Is that helpful to people? You know, that makes all the difference in the world. And we have another lady who comes to our church who is having so much trouble being kind in her family. And her family made that known to us, and we built lessons around those biblical concepts. And they say that it's the best kind of service that has ever been rendered to her because she understands those things and she can relate to them. But what about the ones on the bottom? They probably won't respond very well to the concepts. Nor can they be led to that point of acceptance or whatever word we want to call. But it doesn't exclude them from the challenge that we're talking about. They need us. I have a little fellow that if I described him to you, it would make you feel bad. But we're not even sure how much he hears. We're not really sure about how much he sees. And he spends his days in a little crib where people constantly, 24 hours a day, take care of him. And I like to go by and see him. Now, I mean that. I really enjoy going by to see him. And do you know, he knows now when I'm in the room. I walk over and sit down by his bed and I'll talk a little bit and pat him a little bit. And then after a little bit, he'll turn his hand over. And I'll just lay my hand in his hand. and we'll just sit there and chat for a little bit. Now, he doesn't have parents anymore. As a matter of fact, there are no known relatives, no one to come in to provide that little bit of touch for him. And I like to do that. But Christians, he doesn't know my name. If he knew it, he couldn't say it. But every time I walk through the door, after I finish my little visit, you know what I say under my breath? In the name of Jesus Christ. Now, what I'm suggesting is that Christian education, yes. Christian concepts, yes. But Christian care, yes. So, if that challenge to the church to minister to intellectually handicapped persons, to educate them, to give them concepts, to give them love and care, that is an obligation that every one of us in this room have. And I feel a sense of release when I have shared my burden with as many people as sit here. Because it is our total responsibility. It's a challenge that we cannot eliminate by putting them away in institutions and saying out of sight, out of mind. They're with us and deserve our love and care and concern. Are there any responses or any questions that you would like to ask me? It's now 10:30 or... Okay, now just a minute. I think I need to give you this so we can record your questions. So
three sections, you're educated, trained, and constant care. Let's look at the last one, you're constant...
Can you bring that down just so you can get the feedback like somebody hammering your tent?
Okay.
Good.
With your third one, your constant care, what do you really see that the Christian church should do in that area to those people?
Well, I think that is a real... That's a problem, and I have talked about that subject with several persons since I have been in Australia. I think the church's chief obligation, whether it does it with its own funds or whether it does it by way of encouragement to the government to do the right kinds of things for these persons, it really needs to be done. I don't think we ought to move away from our obligation and responsibility in that area. One of the things that I feel so strongly is that there has got to be a ministry both of caring to the person, not just in that feeling that I want to do something, but they really get the right kind of care and support. But now, the kinds of persons that I'm talking about are people who many times are in the facilities that they're in because they would choke to death if they ate food. You understand what I'm saying? So they're going to have medicine going into this hand to keep them from having seizure activity, and medicine going into this side to provide, nutrients going in this side to keep them alive. So I think the church's role has got to be total concern for their care. It's got to also go, if there are institutions that keep them, we have got to be sure that in whatever system we follow, that care is good care and quality care. Now, I don't want to get in the role of advising the church to do that, but I did say to one person in your beautiful country who asked me that, I said, he wanted to know if I felt that was a ministry that the church needed to get into, and I said yes, because one of the things that happens is that parents want to know if they need to put their youngsters or their oldsters, whichever one it is, into a residential facility, that they're going to be loved and cared about. And I'm convinced that church people have at least the foundation to do that better than anybody else can do it. But now, while I say that, I've got to say that it's a very expensive kind of thing to do. You know, it's 24-hour day care. And there's not much hope that we're going to move any farther from that point. It's going to be a lifetime situation. And with the care, medical care that we give people, their lifespans are longer than they used to be. Am I answering your question?
But now, would you let me do one more level for you? Most of those facilities are going to be close and in communities. And I think the church has a responsibility to do whatever ministerial level that it can do. You know, I think to move in and let the persons know that we care about them. You know, they might not know that we're there, but at least they've got the human touch to know that somebody is available to them. I think that kind of a ministry needs to continue. There was a facility of about 1,800 persons not too far from us, and it is now down to less than 500 because of the American concept of normalization, getting everybody back into the community. And that facility has one of the largest volunteer programs of any facility around. You'll be interested in knowing that it also has one of the best chaplaincy departments around. And I have come to the third thing I want to say. I think another thing that the church can think about is sending chaplains into those kinds of situations to be able to minister to family and to person and on that kind of a level. So the church still has a role. I think it's a role that probably needs to be discussed in terms of the needs that are available, the needs that are expressed in the community, the funds that are available to do it. But you know something when I say that, and I have to operate on that other side of the fence from time to time, worried about budgets and if I'm going to get everybody paid the right things that they think they ought to be paid in line with what everybody else like them to being paid in the community. But I think sometimes we are hampered, not by the lack of funds, but by the lack of creativity in getting ministry to persons that we're talking about. And we have sitting in this room with us today person who has amassed volunteers together to get money, get programs started, that has no government funding in it. And Lynette, my hat's off to you, because I think that's a marvelous thing to do. So yes, I think the church has a role in any of those several areas. But if it gets into, are we going to provide residential care, then I really do think that that's something that is I want to be an outsider now. I don't feel loved anymore. But, I really think that's something that locally you need to get into if that's something that you need to do.
I just want to refer to, not on the constitutional area, but on our church level area, of people caring for individuals in their community. We've got plenty of individuals that need caring for in their homes. And I feel our churches probably are doing this, but I know our church is doing it very much.
Mm.
And there's a big ministry in that way. These people may never be able to come into a church, but you can go to them.
Yes, sir.
And we serve a blind woman that's been handicapped, had a stroke in a wheelchair. She has no desire to go into an institution. But we can do ever so many things for her, and it's all done without any government assistance through the caring of our church and that. And I feel without looking for money and things like that, your caring appeals to me very much, because I feel it's only the little bit of effort you have to put in. And there are a community full of them in Brisbane. I know this because I can't do all that I see. And you can't get enough people to do it because so many have to earn their livings.
That's right.
And that sort of thing.
Yes, I appreciate that comment so much, Ruth. I've heard people say that if the church were doing its job, we wouldn't need the Red Cross.
That's right.
Went to see a little lady one time. A very elderly little lady who was totally incapacitated, could not get out of her house. And she'd always been very active. And she said to me, you know, I had heard all of my life, if the church were doing its job, we wouldn't need the Red Cross. And then she described to me some of the things that the Red Cross had done for her that had not necessarily been done by her church community. And then she said, I hope that I wasn't wrong. But she says the minister came by the other day and said that very same thing to me, and I responded to him by saying, well, if that's so, why do I feel so lonely? So I think caring, one-on-one caring cannot be beat.
As a whole, we can take communion into their homes and things. There's so many churches here represented that I feel if they want to step out, you can.
That's right. Anything else? Any other questions?
It's a question, Jim, but just something that happened in Western Australia, I'm wondering whether you might be able to just comment on, and that was in relation to the girl at Collins House that you dealt with, the Aboriginal girl, if you remember rightly, that came up to you. Since you left, the change in that girl has been so incredible that the staff there just can't recover yet. I'm wondering if you might be able to make a comment about that particular instance.
Susan?
The Aboriginal girl that came up and wouldn't let your hand go and when you went to Colin's house. Said that she wouldn't respond to anyone. She had never responded to anyone apart from them. And you, a complete stranger, walked in and she responded to you.
If I have this puzzled look on my face...
I guess what I'm trying to say is what you did to her was you touched her and you allowed her to touch you. And this was the impact that you left.
Well, I'm losing my cool. That's the first I'd heard about that. No, let me tell you what happened. It was in a... Collins House is a residential facility staffed by a man and a woman. And they have six. And in this, we got there, three boys and three girls. And when we arrived for our visit, the girls had come home from school ahead of the boys. And there was a girl, an Aboriginal girl, Susan, who is deaf. And I would assume almost 100% deaf. It would be my guess that she might have, if she has any hearing, it's 90% in one and total in the other, because she tends to turn her head just a little bit when she tries to, when she hears sound or watches people's. But she just, no, the only thing that happened, she would come over and we'd shake hands and we did that little routine for a while. And then after a minute, she came over and she just sort of laid her head on my shoulder and I just put my arm around her and hugged her. But that's all in the world that I did. I know
it has left such a change in that girl. And nothing like that. She had never responded to anyone apart from the husband and wife team at all. And she has just been so different since that they don't know what you did.
Would you please convey to them that only God knows for sure what I did, all right? All right, we have one more question up front here. Oh, I thought they were going to run me out of Western Australia on a rail. That's what I was really hesitant about getting into that one.
Yes, I'd just like to say that it is very hard to say just what the intellectually handicapped understands and what they don't. Our boy, by testing, is regarded to be around 4 to 5. But I wouldn't say with everything. He was in the bath once. I was bathing him when he was about 13. And I heard him speaking. I just walked out for a minute and I went back. And he's lounging water up on himself. And I made out he was saying, "I've been baptised." So I thought, well, from now on you'll have communion. And it wasn't until he went away with Crossroads, and actually he's used to communion every Sunday, and when he came back he said he went to church good, no table. And before this he had told us he liked going to morning service best. But we didn't know why, because there was more singing at night. But then I said to him, "Do you like morning service because of the Lord's table?" He said, "Yes." So we just praise the Lord, what he's understanding, although he can't be educated. He doesn't write, he doesn't read.
But he knows.
But he knows.
And let me, listen, no, and I don't think I have left a wrong impression, but I want to say this. One of the things that in all of our sophistication and all of our testing materials and all those kinds of things, Nothing takes the place of knowing what an intellectually handicapped person knows as much as the person who works and knows and hears. Yes, yes. And as you watch that development, you'll know what they know. And then you can move up to the next level of teaching and then move up to the next. No, no, I agree. Yeah.
From strength to strength, and
yeah,
it's only prayer and the Lord. That's all it's
that's
doing.
Right. Well, and I think the Lord's probably used a mother and daddy who cared too.
Praise the Lord.